Welcome to the Karen Conti Show on 720 WGN.
Good evening, everyone. I'm happy to be here tonight. We have a great show. We're going to be talking about Jussie Smollett in a few minutes. If you have any comments or questions about that bizarre story, the bizarre turn of events this week, dropping all 16 charges against him. I know media outlets have been talking about it, but I'm going to talk about it a little bit from my perspective as a practicing lawyer, maybe giving you a little bit of insight on how these types of things generally go and why this was a highly unusual situation. And I welcome your calls, 981-7200. If you have questions or comments or you want to vent or you have some perspective about the case, we're happy to discuss that, 981-7200. And then about 7:30 or so, we are going to be talking to Jack Riley, who's a retired DEA agent, and he comes from Chicago, and he worked down in El Paso, Texas, and he was instrumental in capturing El Chapo, Joaquin Guzman, who was convicted last month of many counts regarding trafficking of drugs, probably one of the most successful drug dealers ever in the history of the world. And we're going to talk about that. We're going to talk about, were there any surprises in the El Chapo trial? What does it mean for ongoing opioid crisis? Is this going to change the horrible problem that we have with drugs, or is this just the beginning? We'll also talk a little bit about intelligence and how you get to know where these people are and how they're moving and how you finally catch someone like El Chapo, who was literally digging tunnels to get away from the officials. Anyway, so that'll be about 7:30. And then at 8, as usual, I'll be taking your legal questions on any topic that you might have. Again, on news stories that you hear about, or if you have legal issues or your friends have legal issues, please give us a call here at 981-7200 or text to that same number. So tomorrow is April Fool's Day. Does anybody, you know what, I'd like to hear from you. I love to play jokes on April Fool's Day. I haven't done it in a couple years just because I haven't had the time to really be devious. But has anyone played a really good one on you? Or do you have one planned tomorrow? 981-7200. Call us here. I'd like to hear if you've ever either done one or received one. Some of them can be a little nasty. I wanted to tell you, I had a friend, this was several years back, and she was getting married. And she was bridezilla on steroids. She had like a 500-person wedding. It was at a big country club. She was micromanaging every flower and every candle in the world, and she was just impossible to be around. I was standing up the wedding, and I really kind of had it with her. I'm laughing about it because she was a lovely person, but she wanted everything to be perfect. So I decided what I did was, and this was a few years back because we were still using a lot of faxes back then. I got the country club to fax me their letterhead on something. I pretended like I was interested in renting out their country club. So I took the letterhead and I made up my own letter. And the letter basically said to this lovely lady, the bride, that we are canceling the wedding due to unforeseen circumstances. There was a flood that ruined the entire center of the banquet hall, and that it was an act of God, and therefore she wasn't going to be getting any refunded money on anything, and that we are sorry, and I'm sorry that maybe we can do it next year. And I typed it up. I did it very officially. I went to my friend's fax machine, and I faxed it to her. Oh, my gosh. Oh, my gosh. I realized that as funny as that was, it wasn't funny to her. But it was a good one, don't you think? Or is that too mean? Do you think that's mean? We still laugh about it, and I don't think I've ever had anyone play something like that on me, although tomorrow is another day, as they say. 981-7200. Any April Fool's Day, did I say Cubs already played? Check their website. Oh, that's not April Fool's. I'm glad that isn't. You know, one thing before we start on the Jussie Smollett issue is this leggings controversy. Have you heard about it? University of Notre Dame, there was a mother of four who had the children, had her boys, I guess, on campus. And she said that there were girls wearing leggings at mass. And so she wrote a letter to the university, the mom, and she expressed her concern for the young males who would be thrown into struggle with purity of heart by what she described as blackly naked rear ends. Quote, I didn't want to see them, but they were unavoidable. How much more difficult for young guys to ignore them? Basically, she was worried that her boys and other boys would be so distracted by women in leggings that they would do something impure. I guess that was the import of that. So, of course, some of the organizations on campus declared Legging Pride Day, and they were asked to post photos of themselves wearing their favorite leggings. I don't know. What do you think about that? I mean, leggings. Jerry and I, my husband and I, talk about this all the time. You can call them leggings, you can call them tights, you can call them yoga pants. But in my, and again, you know, you might say that I'm body shaming. I'm not body shaming, but I just don't think that leggings are something that most women should wear. I mean, even if you have a great figure, you're going to not look great in them, probably, unless you're the 1% of the population. And I don't know, they're just too much information. And I see them in court. I see girls wearing leggings in court with, you know, a sweater on top so you can see every inch of their butt and their legs. And, you know, it just, and they're wearing flat shoes, and it looks like they're going to yoga. I just don't think that's professional wear. I see girls going to work in my office building. I would say at least half of them are wearing black tights, black leggings. I just don't think it's appropriate. And again, I don't mind seeing a woman showing off her assets and looking sexy and looking pretty and looking attractive, but it just seems to me that it's just too much information. Just too much. I don't know. Maybe I'm wrong. Anyway, when we come back, we're going to be talking about Jussie Smollett. I know you have opinions and questions about it. 981-7200. You'll talk to Ben, my producer, and we'll get you on the air, and we'll chat a little bit about all of the counts that were dropped. We'll be back in a minute. Did you hear that Mick Jagger canceled his concerts? We still don't know exactly what his medical issue was, do we? Yeah, I don't know if we're going to, but that's too bad. He's 75 years old. 75 years old. Oh, my goodness. All right, so I'm talking about this leggings case. It's got a lot of legs here. This is the case. It comes out of Notre Dame, and the mother was just basically wrote a letter to the newspaper at Notre Dame saying, hey, girls, don't wear these leggings because you're, like, distracting my sons, you're distracting men, and they might do something that's impure. And I'm getting a lot of good texters. Leggings on beautiful young women, wonderful, much better than leggings on Jussie Smollett. That was funny. Let's see. What else? Oh, someone reminded me that we had mini skirts back in the 60s. And that's true. Those were revealing. And that was pure skin, right? So I guess I have to move on and modernize my thinking, right? I had a woman, who texted in and said her daughters cannot wear leggings at church. And I don't know if that's not to distract the men or if she thinks that that's just inappropriate and maybe not dressy enough for the sanctity of church. Debbie, hi, welcome to the Karen Conti Show. Do you have a question about the leggings?
Well, I'm so glad that you're talking about this because I had seen the story about the Notre Dame mother and how she was vilified because of her comments. And I'm sorry. Well, I'm not sorry. I don't think leggings are, they're not for everybody. They're for very few people. And especially worn in church or when I'm going up the communion aisle and I see a girl in a tank top and leggings and flip-flops, nobody seems to care that they should have respect for God, respect for themselves, their bodies. If you have a young teenage daughter, teach her some respect. And you talk about body shaming. There are a lot of women out there. It's mean to say, but they're wearing these geometric leggings, and you're just bowled over when you see them.
Well, they're not flattering on 99% of people. And listen, even people who are not overweight, you know, you just they show every single bulge and every inch of everything. I don't know. I would feel very uncomfortable walking around, like maybe in a gym class, of course, but even then I don't wear them. I'll wear a t-shirt on top of them because I don't want people to see every inch of me.
Yes.
But, and then there you're talking about a little something different, too, which is respect for the church. And I think there are probably a lot of older listeners here who are thinking, gosh, when we went to church, we dressed up. We wore our Sunday best. Or when we got on airplanes and we traveled, we wore nice clothes. And that's not the case anymore. And, you know,
they are everywhere now. They are everywhere. And in the beginning, they were made of a little bit thicker material, I think, maybe something a little darker. Now, white, yellow, see-through, beige. I've seen some that are flesh-colored, and you do a double take. And I just think they're kind of awful, and I just think people should look at their children, their young daughters, maybe from the back. A dad, if you have a teenage daughter, look at her from the back as she's walking out of your house sometime with some of those on, and then tell me what you think.
Debbie, thank you for the call.
So that's my opinion.
I appreciate it.
I really enjoy your show.
Thanks, Deb. Thanks for calling. Like texter, leggings may not be appropriate in court work or other situations. Probably don't look good on most women. However, if boys or young men... And it just moved here. If boys or young men, I think, are tempted by it, the text was saying, that they have so little control over themselves that they can't behave in a gentlemanly fashion when seeing a woman in leggings, it's a much bigger problem than the inappropriateness of a woman's clothing. When do we stop making excuses for men's bad behavior because how a woman is dressed? Carol, thank you. I do agree with you 100%. And I didn't like that part of the woman's letter to the editor. It's fine to say, I think, that, you know, they're inappropriate. They're not dressy enough. They show too much. Should we be, you know, doing that kind of, having that kind of behavior in a church in Notre Dame? But I totally agree with you that I thought that mother's comment, like, hey, don't tempt my sons. Well, sons, why don't you just stop staring then? And why don't you stop thinking and objectifying women? Because women, you know, are going to wear things that are revealing. And you see it on television. You see it everywhere. And that doesn't mean that they can't control themselves. And I totally agree with you 100%. All right. We don't have a lot of time for Jesse. And maybe that's good because maybe you're sick and tired of it. But I did want to mention a couple of things about the case. And of course, this is the Empire actor who was charged with 16 counts of disorderly conduct for making a false police report or lying to the police several times. And basically, the allegations were that he fabricated a hate crime, etc. And you all know the facts here. Here's what I really think was wrong. And as I said this on Brian's crosstalk, Brian Noonan, you know, basically the prosecutor should have been talking to the police all along and saying, listen, maybe we had a change of one of the witnesses or maybe one of the pieces of evidence that we had, it was not as good. We need to plead this down. And, you know, we plead down cases all the time. And disorderly conduct is sort of a catch-all for a lot of different things. And those cases generally don't go to trial. And there's usually some sort of either a dismissal of charges or a plea bargain, especially if the defendant doesn't have a prior record. But in this case, this was a super high-profile case, not just in Chicago, not just nationally, but internationally. And this is the kind of case, if the prosecutor had enough evidence to charge 16 counts, which a lot of people said was overkill, and if you read the proffer letter, there's a letter called a proffer letter that the prosecutors prepared for the court in asking for, in setting the bail. It's 4 pages, single-spaced, with great details of the texts and what the text said and when they happened and the exact timeline of when he got off the plane and when he went home and how he went out at 20 below zero weather and went to the subway and who bought the rope. It is one of the most convincing set of facts that you're going to read. Now, what happened between the time of the charging and the time that those were dropped? That's what I would like to know, and that's what the police were entitled to know. They should have known ahead of time that this was coming down. They should have known and prepared themselves. They should have had some input. And even the prosecutors could have made him plead guilty to something. Maybe a lesser charge. I don't even know what that would be. One count of something. And maybe part of it was he didn't get to go around and say he was innocent. Maybe there was a gag order on him. Maybe he doesn't get to say that the police are bad and the city of Chicago is treating him unfairly and his lawyers are bad-mouthing the prosecutors. Maybe that would be part of the plea bargain. You know, and how about asking him to pay the $100,000 or so, whatever the expenses were in the investigation that diverted precious resources from the city of Chicago? That could have been packaged in a deal that everyone could have walked away and said, all right, there was justice done on both sides. He got to walk away without spending time in jail. He can move on with his career, maybe. And the city of Chicago can walk on saying, you know, you shouldn't be doing these things. This is an example that we're going to set that no matter how rich and famous you are, you cannot lie to the police, and especially about something as serious as a hate crime, because we have hate crimes. And hate crimes are terrible, but you know, this has got done, I think, a great injustice to people who really have been afflicted by hate crimes. You're listening to The Karen Kadzi Show on WGN. The theme from the movie El Chapo. Yes, there's a movie, and there will be more movies and more movies and more books. Joaquin Guzman, aka El Chapo, the notorious Mexican drug lord, was finally caught, tried, and convicted in a New York court last month. The question is, how did El Chapo become the biggest drug lord ever in the history of the world? And how is he finally caught? And how does this change this horrible drug epidemic that we have in this country? Joining us tonight is retired DEA agent Jack Riley, dubbed Chicago's most famous federal agent since The Untouchables, and author of the book Drug Warrior, Inside the Hunt for El Chapo and the Rise of America's Opioid Crisis. Hi, Jack. Welcome to the show.
Well, thank you so much. It's my pleasure.
I enjoyed the book very much, and it kind of spans the country. You're living in different places and doing different jobs here. But one of the things that I want to talk a little bit about is you talk at the beginning of your book about how you were basically apprehending street dealers, and that was something that you were charged to do, and you did, undercover buys and those types of things. Is that an effective way to fight the drug problem in our country?
Well, you know, it's funny. In the early part of my career, we were really tied up in metrics because we thought the most people we could arrest, the most drugs we could seize, guns and money, would have an effect on the organizations in which we were dealing with. But we really didn't think about really what was the impact. And the impact had to be much like organized crime, the way we attack that was, how do we get to the command and control structure of these organizations? So that was really a tough thing for people to understand, certainly for our agency to understand that we needed to do more about attacking the organizations. Congress really had looked at us like, how many people do you arrest? How many kilos of drugs do you seize in guns and money? But the point was, we really didn't understand what we were up against in terms of the cartels.
So, you know, at the end of the book, you have a scene where you're at Wrigley Field watching a baseball game, and you realize that the capacity of Wrigley Field is 41,000 and change, and that the number of people who died in the year you were sitting there, 2018, was somewhere around that same number. And that, you know, even, you know, we think about terrorism is a huge problem in this country, but this is an epidemic. I mean, is this the biggest problem that we have, or at least one of the biggest problems?
You know, it's undeniably, this is one of the worst things I think this country's ever dealt with. If you look at the numbers, 130 of U.S. citizens, our friends, our family members, die every day of drug abuse. And much of that is opioid-related. So for me, even back 10 years ago, I saw it coming and I thought to myself, what are we going to do as a country to combat this? But most importantly, we had to let everyone know what we were up against. And at that point, you know, if you look at what was going on in Mexico, our friends south of the border, it was out of control. And to a certain extent, it still is today. But we had to do a better job here domestically in combating it and talking about it and making sure, you know, our policymakers understood what was going on.
And I always like to try to educate, well, myself, but also my listeners about how things work. And, you know, you are involved in these high profile investigations and trying to get El Chapo. And we're going to talk a little bit about El Chapo in a minute. But how all of these agencies, the DEA and the FBI and the IRS and the ATF, and then we have the U.S. Attorney's Office, the prosecutors. Can you just briefly explain to our listeners how all of these organizations intertwine and interplay to deal with the drug trafficking problem?
Well, you know, and that's a great question because everybody is confused about how these agencies who have different missions, different sets of laws that they enforce, but how important it is for them to talk to each other. And one of the things I can tell you explicitly is that Chapo Guzman and much of those traffickers really counted on the fact that they believed that U.S. law enforcement wouldn't talk to each other. We wouldn't connect the dots. The good guys would not talk to the good guys. And therefore, his organizations could make inroads into what we did across the country. And I think, honest to God, I think he was right. Now, we've come completely around, I think, since 9/11. We realize that we had to communicate. You know, the state police had to talk to the local police. DEA had to talk to FBI and ATF. And everyone really had to share information because if you were going to attack criminal organizations like we've never seen before, and Chapo Guzman in Sinaloa was really the number one criminal entity we've dealt with in this world, with the exception of Osama bin Laden, you had to talk to each other. And that was a difficult thing for egos, for agencies, for really everybody in law enforcement to understand we had to share information. We had to connect the dots. We're doing it much better today than we did 10 years ago.
We're talking to Jack Riley, who's the author of the book Drug Warrior, about drug trafficking and the catching of El Chapo. El Chapo has gotten an insane amount of attention. In fact, I just read today, of all things, that apparently his wife went into the prison and he signed some paperwork giving her the rights to a clothing line. we're now going to see, special smocks for smuggling or tunneling pants or something. Who knows what we're going to see. But this guy has gotten so much attention, and it's almost like, you know, in your book you say a lot of people in Mexico, and I've heard this when I have been in Mexico, that he's sort of like the Robin Hood, and he's kind of giving from, you know, taking from the rich and giving to the poor. Tell us about El Chapo. What is this guy all about?
Well, let's make it very clear. Number one, he's a mass murderer of grand proportions, unlike I think we've never seen before. But one of the things, and we talk about this in the book all the time, and certainly my 20 years of trying to run him down, was he was a brilliant businessman, a logistical genius in terms of understanding how to get the product across our border, either through tunnels or other really smart ways of moving it, cars and buses, concealed compartments across the border, and getting it into the United States and meeting the demand, unfortunately, of what was necessary here in the U.S. And I just don't think people understand how vicious, how well-financed, and really far ahead of many other criminal people he was. He saw it as an entity. Now, he didn't convene a corporate a board meeting in a conference room, but he really ran it as it. And I think that's one of the things that, for me, was important for the American people to understand, as the trial, I think, demonstrated just how vicious and uncalculating these people are to hurt the U.S. As he was.
Well, you know, he's definitely a sociopath. I mean, obviously, and even some of the things that I heard in the trial were shocking about him having sex with young girls and all these things. I mean, he didn't stop at anything when it comes to amorality. But this is a guy who, like, dropped out of second grade. I mean, this was a guy who was, and not that, you know, education is necessary to be a good businessman, but from what little of any kind of upbringing he had, This was a just that's what is astounding to me about the numbers in El Chapo, and the fact that he avoided apprehension for such a long period of time. Well, when we come back, I want to talk a little bit about how you got intelligence and how the intelligence worked to run him down, and some of the roadblocks along the way in catching El Chapo. We're listening to WGN, Karen Conti. I'm here with Jack Riley, author of Drug Warrior.
Feel like El Chapo, Holy Grail, El Chapo. Feeling like El Chapo, Holy Grail, El Chapo. Patron, 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 patron. Ain't nothing that can happen.
DEA special agent in charge, Jack Riley, led the manhunt for El Chapo, and he wrote a book called Drug Warrior, Inside the Hunt for El Chapo and the Rise of America's Opioid Crisis. And he's joining me here tonight to talk about his book. Hi, Jack, again. How are you?
I'm doing great.
Now, let's talk a little bit about the trial that went on in New York City. I believe it was about a six-week trial. I know Chicago vied for that trial, and some people here wanted to have it tried here in Chicago, but New York had the honor of prosecuting him. And during the trial, it was revealed that El Chapo gave a $100 million bribe or something in that vicinity to the Mexican president at the time. Do you think that that's true?
Well, I will tell you this. First of all, I fought very hard as the DEA boss in Chicago to have it have the trial in Chicago. But I will make it very clear. I think he was capable of doing that to the president. I'm not sure about the money, but I can tell you that Chapo and Sinaloa was literally in the pockets of virtually every corner of the Mexican government, and that really made him be able to survive for over 20 years. You know what's really important, and people don't get it? He survived the transition of a president of Mexico three times. Unheard of for a narco trafficker. And the only reason he was able to do that was because he had everyone greased. And I think people don't really grasp his strength at his height. And it certainly was nothing like DEA had ever seen. And I'm just so glad he's sitting where he is right now, because that's where he should be.
Jack, we think, you know, I hear it all the time, our system is corrupt and our politicians are corrupt. But it's nothing like we see in Mexico, or at least we used to see in Mexico, where, you know, you got people tunneling into the prison, you got people bringing women into the prison and doing all these things just for money. Why could this happen in the United States, and why doesn't it happen in the United States, and why did it happen in Mexico for so many years that people were able to bribe the officials?
Well, first of all, I think in Central and South America, the corruption issue is really part of their culture. And unfortunately, the narcotic trafficking thing is literally, 50, 60 years old. But before that, that was the way that they navigated themselves, I think, in illegal migration and illegal, certainly importation, and just smuggling. But here in the United States, and this is one of the things I'm most proud of, and I hear it all the time, well, what does it matter that Chapo Guzman's in jail? Let me tell you something. We worked a relationship with our Mexican counterparts, which was terrible years ago. We couldn't trust them for anything, but we found a bond. We built bridges to make it sure that they understood we were doing the right thing and we trusted each other. Chapo would have never been caught twice, not once, but twice, without the assistance of the Mexican Marines. And he wouldn't be sitting in prison in New York and hopefully shortly in Colorado if it wasn't for their help. But here's the message it sends. Wherever you are, and whatever you choose to do illegally, whether it's narcotic trafficking or terrorist-related activities, we're going to reach out and work to try to bring you to the U.S. justice system. And I guarantee you, in fact, I can assure you from things that I know, from informants, people that were arrested and for legal wiretaps, that the one thing Chapo was most afraid of, more than a bullet to his head from a rival, was facing the U.S. justice system. And I think that is so important, and it makes such a difference in terms of the message we send across the world.
Well, and going to Florence, Colorado, which is probably where he will spend his golden years, you know, is a place where no one could possibly escape. I mean, it's the most secure place in the world, and there's no tunneling to get him out of there. Right? So he will
absolutely
he will be there, and he'll spend most of his time alone, which is very hard on those people, you know, and which is fine for most of us. And he will live out his days there. So, how much money? Can you quantify for our listeners about how much money he made over the course of his life, or how much in drug trafficking he did?
Well, I think one of the things that people don't understand about, specifically about Chapo Guzman, is I don't think it was ever about the money. It was about the power and control. It was about his ability to really flex his muscles across the narcotic trafficking cartels, but also the Mexican government. And that's a scary thing when you think that they're just south of our border. But clearly billions of dollars. If you just look at the Flores twins in Chicago, the money that was pumped from Chicago through Chicago back to Mexico was literally hundreds of millions of dollars. And I think if that doesn't get someone's attention, and, you know, the one thing we don't connect this to is if Chapo had chose to make a connection with terrorist-related organizations and his ability to cross the border, either through tunnels or his extension organizations that come across the border, this was a threat the U.S., I think, had never faced before. And I think people need to understand it. That's why I'm so glad they had an opportunity to see and hear what went on in the trial, because this truly, to me, is a national security issue.
El Chapo said himself that when you catch me, it's not going to be the end of it. In your book, you say this is not the end of it. And I just had a texter text me and say, now that he's in jail, what ramification? Will someone just take over where he left off? Will it splinter the different drug traffickers? What will happen now, Jack?
Well, unfortunately, Sinaloa and many of the cartels are much like military organizations. If a general is killed or removed, there's someone very willing to take control. And in Sinaloa's, if you consider them today, Chapo's two sons really have ascended to try to run it. And I think that's important to understand, that these organizations are international, and they affect the way that we live in this country. Now, will it stop them? Will it stop the complete narcotic trafficking in the world? Absolutely not. But if we don't take a stand and have a robust law enforcement present, both domestically and international, we are going to encourage these types of organizations to take abuse. Now, I will tell you this, and I'll be honest straight up. 15 years ago, I would have told you we could arrest our way out of it. There's no way we can. We have to do this as a combined way of looking at the problem with education and treatment, and make all of this important as one package so the American people understand what we're trying to do. You know, I was a cop. I'm not a policymaker. I'm not a politician. And I told Congress that many, many times. It's up to you people to understand what the problem is and then how to legislate it. And we'd be happy to, obviously, enforce the laws. And I think what people don't understand is, why are we fighting this battle that apparently is unending? Well, the reason we are is because the addiction issue, the whole problem of foreign entities, criminal organizations, supplying our addiction issue, no one's really addressed, and that's what we have to do. And the older I get, it's just a big picture of what we need to do as a future, and I don't think anybody wants to really listen to that.
And just we've got to take a break in like 10 seconds, but if you bullet point some people that, you know, unscrupulous doctors, pharmaceutical companies, there's like a whole global solution that, and I know you're a cop and you're not a legislator, but you're on the street and you saw it and you saw how it worked and affected people. Are there any other places we can go to stop this crisis? I mean, people's addiction will continue, but people need the supply. What are the bullet points? If you had five bullet points to change the law or to change the world to stop this, what would they be?
Well, my number one would be, let's use the State Department criteria for naming foreign terrorist organizations that bring so much more resources to our ability to affect them overseas. And those should be cartels, as exactly what we did with Al-Qaeda and Hamas. Let's do that. Let's bring the full force of the American government to try to do the right thing in a foreign entity to stop these organizations that are hell-bent on killing our people. And then domestically, we've got to do a better job educating and providing treatment. No question about it.
Jack, thank you so much for joining us. I highly recommend the book, Jack Riley, DEA Special Agent, Drug Warrior, Inside the Hunt for El Chapo and the Rise of America's Opioid Crisis. Thank you so much for joining us, Jack. You take care.
My pleasure.
All right, take care. Let's go to coming up, the stories that matter with Don Kleppen from the Northwestern Medicine Newsroom on WGN Radio.
She's legally blonde and brilliant. Karen Conti, attorney at law, is taking your legal questions right now. Call 312-981-7200. That's 312-981-7200.
Breaking rocks in a hot sun. I'm on the law.
This is the time for you to call with your legal questions, any topic you might have. If you still want to talk about Jussie Smollett and you have some comments or questions about how the state's attorney's office works or these types of cases, I'll be happy to weigh in. Or if you want to just share some thoughts, happy to listen to them. 981-7200 or text to that same number, 981-7200. I also, take calls at my office if you don't want to get on the phone here or text me here. You always can call me at the office. I try to either answer your question, if I can, give you a link or give you some information where you can get that answer, or if necessary, refer you to a lawyer who might practice in that area who can help you, whether it's an estate planning issue or a criminal defense issue, workers' comp. These are areas that I may not practice in, but I have people who are trusted and I know who I can refer you to in your area, hopefully, who can do a good job for you. 312-981-7200, and I'll give you my office number and my email address there. My office number is 312-332-7800, and you can always email me at wgn@askkarenconti.com, KarenConti. You know what? Let's just talk a little bit about some news stories that I saw that might be kind of useful in learning a little bit about the law, which I think a lot of people like to learn about. Nicolas Cage, the actor, got married in Las Vegas about 4 days ago. And 4 days later, he filed for an annulment. He changed his mind. He said he was too intoxicated to know what he was doing, and he wanted to annul the marriage. Now, you remember Nicolas Cage, Moonstruck, National Treasure. He was in Leaving Las Vegas, wasn't he? He was in Leaving Las Vegas. So anyway, he got married to a makeup artist. While he was there, he applied for the permit right then and there, got married right then and there. And 4 days later, no longer a blushing bride, he wants to get the marriage annulled. And a lot of people don't really understand what annulment is versus a divorce and when you can get one and when you can get another. Ending a marriage is really two ways, and that's divorce and annulment. Divorce, there has to be a valid marriage, and then in Illinois, at least, it's no fault, which means you don't have to plead that someone is cheating. You don't have to say in the divorce you have to catch them cheating or they're doing drugs or they abandon the family or any of those things. You basically just have the phrase irreconcilable differences, which means you aren't getting along, and that can mean a number of things. And then you get a divorce, and the judge will then split up property and give spousal support if that is appropriate, and do all of those things relating to the children and award child support and things like that. Now, an annulment, and I'm just going to give you the Illinois law. It varies from state to state. But basically, it basically means that the marriage was void. Okay, so there's basically four grounds for annulling a marriage: illegality, lack of consent, inability to consummate the marriage, or the person was under the age of 18 without parental consent. And so some of the inability to consummate, you see that very rarely. You see most people are consummating before the marriage these days. And under 18, you rarely see that. But you do see illegality, a void marriage. You see that, I had a case where a man wanted to marry somebody from Pakistan and brought her here. It was an arranged marriage through family. It was very traditional. So then the woman got here and spent just the right number of days and then basically left because she just wanted to get, citizenship. She wanted to be on that path, and she really didn't want to be married at all. She was using it as a way to get into the country. And so we were able to annul the marriage. But you have to do it in a certain amount of time. Usually it's 90 days. You have to discover the fraud or the illegality, and then you have to ask the court to undo it. And courts will grant an annulment. They don't like to do that. But if both parties agree and you have the facts there that are established within 90 days, the courts will generally do that. Why would you want one or another? The annulment, the effect of annulment is really that you just pretend like the marriage never happened. So there will never be maintenance or spousal support. There's no property division because you're not acquiring property jointly as a couple. And so you basically have no obligations to each other. It was as if the marriage never happened. There are people who also feel like, they don't want to have to say they were married. And maybe even from a religious standpoint, they want to be able to say they were never married. Although annulment in terms of religion, and you see this in the Catholic Church, that is a totally separate issue. Doesn't have anything to do with the legality of the marriage. You can be divorced and you can still get an annulment in the Catholic Church. I have no idea how that process works anymore. I mean, I know there's a avenue for that in the church, but that has nothing to do with legality. So that's there you have it. There you have the annulment 101. Give us a call here. I've got plenty of time and plenty of phone lines open. 312-981-7200. Another case that I saw that reared its head this week, a woman in California successfully sued her ex-husband for child support for their 52-year-old daughter. Toni Anderson makes no apologies for going after the man. She calls her deadbeat ex some 50 years after he left her with their 3-year-old daughter. So Anderson says her ex-husband chose to go to Canada rather than pay court-ordered support in the 1970s. And she said she put it on the back burner, forgot about it. She supported her daughter, and now she is collecting. So it's very interesting. There are a lot of, and it goes both ways. It could be the father has custody of the children, but largely it's the woman, and the man is paying child support, especially back in 50 years ago. And sometimes women don't want to be bothered, or they don't have the funds for an attorney, or maybe they just went through a bad divorce and they feel like it's just a waste of energy and maybe the person is not working anyway. And sometimes, sometimes mothers will feel like maybe if he doesn't want to see the child, it's best that the child gets to live a life without a dad there who doesn't really want to see him or her. There's all kinds of reasons. But be that as it may, there's no statute of limitations, meaning that you can come back and get, if there's a child support order in place, and believe me, the judgment will reflect interest and penalties and all of those things. And if you're out there and you owe child support, don't think that you're out of in the clear, because the person can come back at any time. There's no statute of limitations. The child support, even if when the child is emancipated and is an adult and has children on her own, you can still go back and collect that money. And I see it happen where it's into the hundreds of thousands of dollars. And these are times, these kinds of situations where people just can't dig out. They just can't dig out of it. I mean, how do you pay off $150,000 at a certain point? So if you have any questions about that, let me know. And we've got a bunch of calls, and I'm going to get to all of you, including Francis. I've got 608 area code. Give us a call here, and I'll answer your legal questions as best I can. 981-7200 or text to that same number. You're listening to The Karen Conti Show on WGN. Keep the calls coming in. I'm going to try to get to all of you. 981-7200. Any legal questions or comments? Texter said in the California case, could the child, 53-year-old child, have any claim to the unpaid support? Maybe in the case the mother opted not to pursue it or could not pursue it. And the answer is state to state. In Illinois, the child has no right to go after the child support on her own. I don't know what the law is in California on that. I don't think in California the child can do that individually. Normally speaking, it's the mother's or the parent's right to get the support because the parent is the one who has the judgment against the spouse, the ex-spouse. But that's a good question. 981-7200, I'm taking all of your legal questions. Hi, Francis. Welcome to the show. You have a question.
Hi. Thank you. In 2015, my husband and I got a legal separation agreement order entered. And I just want to know for sure, is it legal for me to remain as a spouse on his health insurance?
You're on your husband's group policy with his work?
Right, from work.
Okay. Yep. And this is, I want to make sure that this is a legal separation, right? Court, and you went to court and you filed it?
Right.
Okay.
Rolling Meadows.
Because it's very unusual to get a legal separation. People think those are common because separation, you know, leaving the house is separation, but a legal separation is very unusual. But if that is in fact a legal separation, that is one of the reasons that you get a legal separation is because you can then still usually stay on the husband's group policy. But the best way to find that out is to get the paperwork to make sure that you're covered. Because listen, what happens all the time is I see that a spouse will put the ex-spouse on the insurance. And right. You can't be on the insurance if you're divorced, okay? You're not part of the group anymore. So in those situations, say something, God forbid, happened to you, the insurance company could realize, oh, you're not married. You shouldn't have been on the policy. You're not working there. You're not, and then deny coverage to you. So you should really make sure that that is, that's the case and that you have all those ducks in a row. Did your lawyer look into that when he or she got you separated?
You know, we had many drafts of the agreement, and then everything changed in the last second, and the final thing was entered, and it was, you know, 3 years ago, almost four. And to be honest here, I have been really hesitating using the insurance because it feels illegal.
Yeah.
But I've been on the insurance with him for the last 15 years.
Okay. Well, you know, I don't know how you do this, but, can you ask your spouse to
I have a card. It works.
Okay,
this last weekend.
Okay. Yeah, and that's not the question, because you can have a card that works, but if the insurance company suspects, you know, all of a sudden you have a big claim, they're going to look into it, and they're going to say, why are you on the policy if you're not married? You know, what I'm saying is you need to make sure, because the card could work, but at the end of it, when you're done with your treatment and there's thousands of dollars, they may not cover it. Mm-hmm. So, all right?
Right.
Good luck
Thank
with that,
you.
Francis. Take care. All right.
Bye.
Bye-bye. Okay. Oops. Oh, sorry about that. All right, Randy. Hi, Randy. Welcome to the WGN Karen Conti Show. How are you?
Hi, Karen. I'm fine. Anyway, my question is about a ingress-egress easement that my neighbor has over my land. And he's mad at me because I won't let him park on the land. So when he cleans the snow, which he has the right to do if need to be, he goes out of his way to make an enormous mess. Every year I have to clean up this mess. So I was wondering if there's anything I can do about that.
Okay.
I'm going to hang up my phone and listen to you on the radio.
Okay, Randy, one question, though. Does he have the right? Where's the easement, and what's the easement for? Can you explain that?
Yeah, it's an ingress egress easement, meaning he has the right to come in,
okay,
go out, and come back again. He doesn't have the right to park on my land, store anything on my land. He just has the right to go across it.
Okay. All right. All right, Randy. The answer to that is, first of all, I would want to read the easement and then see exactly what it says and what his rights are. And I see this all the time because, you know, when you're, you know, granting an easement is kind of intrusive because this is on your land and he can come there and do that. I take it he shovels the snow, he makes a big mess, and that impacts his ability to enjoy his land, and he has to fix it and clean it up. He can't do that. And technically, you would have a right to sue him for damage to your property, to maybe some sort of trespass if the mess is going outside of the easement and is messing up areas that are near there. I guess there would be a potential nuisance lawsuit. Again, bringing a lawsuit over those things, you just don't want to do it because you're talking thousands and thousands of dollars. And whatever I deal with these property disputes and these neighbor disputes, they can be so nasty because you can't enjoy your land, you can't enjoy your property because you got some jerk who's just trying to tick you off, and these things become huge problems, and I've seen them go violent. There sometimes the villages and the towns will have dispute resolution procedures where you can have mediators come in and try to mediate a resolution. You can hire a lawyer to take, you know, to send a letter saying, here's the picture of what you did to the land. This is the cost of cleaning it up. If you don't stop this, we're going to bring the lawsuit. You know, there's all kinds of things you can do. But, you know, yelling and screaming is probably not a good thing. If you send a letter, my guess is that he's not going to do anything to remedy it, just because if he's trying to antagonize you, he probably is going to like getting the letter from you. But I think if you bring in a third party, if you can, if you bring in a lawyer to draft the letter, maybe he won't find it fun anymore. Maybe it won't be fun and games, and you can get to enjoy your property as you want. All right, let's go to Bruce. Hi, Bruce. Welcome to WGN.
Hey, Karen.
Hi.
Hey. In 1981, I was wrongly convicted and imprisoned, Cook County Jail, for robbery and battery. And it's a crime I did not commit. The person I was convicted with, I am 100% sure he committed the crime with somebody else. I know the person's name now who committed the crime with him. I want my name exonerated.
Okay, so
I want this off my record.
So, Bruce, that you were convicted. Did you go to trial and you were convicted by a jury?
I was convicted by a judge.
By a judge, okay. This is really touchy because you would have to have the police reopen the case, and you'd have to have the evidence to overcome this. And the police and the prosecutors would have to have the desire to spend the energy and the resources in doing it. This is going to be hard for you to do because, like I said, you know, are they going to spend the time and the resources? I mean, if there were DNA, I take it your knowledge of who actually did it was based upon what somebody said.
Basically, yes.
Yeah. Yeah, this is going to be hard. I mean, you could conceivably hire somebody, a private investigator, to put together, the information, and then you could have a lawyer maybe call the prosecutor and see if they would consider reopening the case. But my guess is you're going to have a very hard time, especially because all this time has gone by since the conviction. But why don't you send me an email at the office, and let me see if I can think of somebody who might be able to help you out. Okay, I need to think about this a little more. All right, Bruce?
Okay, what's the email?
Okay, the email is WGN@AskKarenConti.com. Thanks for calling, Bruce. I'm still taking your calls. We've got a lot of phone lines open. 981-7200, 312-981-7200, or text to that number. We're going to take a break, and we'll come back, and then we're going to hit news, and we'll hit the last half an hour, and the phone lines will be open. Karen Conti Show.
Habitat for Humanity's vision is a world where everyone has a decent place to live. The data is clear. Children and parents who grow up in secure and safe housing will be healthier, excel in school or work, and suffer less stress. You can help make the dream of home ownership a reality by volunteering or donating to Habitat. Visit ChicagolandHabitat.org today to find your local Habitat for Humanity.
So give us a call here. I'm going to give out the numbers again, 981-7200, 981-7200. And I just had a very good texter say, hi, Karen, why would people get a legal separation instead of a divorce? Great question. And people sometimes think they want a legal separation because it doesn't sound as bad as a divorce. But usually, I mean, for 33 years of practicing law, I think I've gotten someone a legal separation maybe twice in my whole career. That's how rare it is. And the only time that you really would do that is, number one, let's just say you had a religious issue and you didn't want to ever be divorced and you think that legal separation is different than divorce and that makes you happier and makes you feel that you're complying with your religion. That would be one reason. Number two, have to be with health insurance. So this lady that just called in, generally speaking, if you're legally separated, you can still stay on the group policy of your spouse. Whereas if you're divorced, you're not part of the group anymore. Also, I've seen couples stay married for purposes of Social Security benefits. Perhaps there's a benefit to staying married and getting that person Social Security or logging in more years so that technically you're not divorced and you're really just in an issue of a legal separation. But you know, the difference between the two, other than those things, you still have to file in court. You still have to, it's still an adversary proceeding. You still have to sort it out with the judge. If you can't settle and resolve the disputes, you have to go to trial. So it's really the same amount of work as a divorce, but at the end of it, you don't have a divorce. And I tell people, you know, you may not want to be divorced now, but what if you meet somebody? And what if you want to move on with your life? And what if you really do want to get divorced? You're going to have to go through the process all over again, which really makes no sense. So again, most people that come to me wanting a legal separation end up getting a divorce. Nine eight one seven two hundred. Phone lines are wide open. We've got lots of callers, but we're going to try to get to everyone. Hi, Diane. You've been holding for a while. I appreciate it. Hi, welcome to the show.
Hi, Karen. Thanks so much for taking my call. The reason I'm calling is I recently wanted to start up at a gym, and I looked over the facility, and they gave me some paperwork to sign before I started out there, including a waiver and assumption of risk, and also waiver, release, and hold harmless agreement. And I was reading it over, and I was really too scared to sign it, and because it seems like that I put myself in a bad situation because it's hold harmless the facility, and it seems like any and all situations.
Well, you know,
I don't know if you're familiar with these documents.
Yeah, I've seen them, and they're really standard, and almost all gyms will make you sign some version of that. And generally speaking, what you're really signing away is, you know, that you're saying that you've had yourself checked out, and what they don't want is for you to have a heart attack there and then blame the gym, okay? Because that's what people do. They sue the gym because they got on a treadmill and they didn't get it, you know. So this basically says you've seen a doctor. The doctor says it's okay for you to exercise. But they go beyond that sometimes, and they'll say,
yes, they do.
Like, even if it's our fault, we won't pay, and we're going to hold you harmless. Now, not all of those are enforceable. So let's just say that you got on the treadmill, and the belt broke, and the gym knew before that there were problems with the belts breaking, and they failed to fix it, and they didn't fix it correctly, whatever. And they should have known, or they knew or should have known that it was going to do that, and as a result, you break your leg. My best legal opinion is you could probably still sue the gym for that, even if there was some release that arguably covered that, because I'm not sure that a gym can sign away their liability on things like that. But I don't, you know, it's not worth it to get a lawyer to, you know, to look at it, because, you know, if you don't sign it, they probably won't let you in. You know.
So that's what I was wondering. Should I have someone look over this?
Yeah,
first?
But it's probably,
I'm worried, you know, if something happens, it says caused in the whole or in part by the negligence or fault of the
gym,
the place,
right,
that is the gym, that there's still
You can't, they're held harmless.
Yeah, and Diane, what I said was, I'm not sure that that's enforceable, but they're going to put it in there anyway. And, what are you going to do about it? If your lawyer is not going to be able to change it, this is a standard contract. They're probably told if you don't sign it, then you don't get a gym membership. But thank you for calling, and I appreciate it. All right, let's go to, how about Mike? Let's go to Mike. Hi, welcome to the Karen Conti Show. Hi, Mike. Hello, Mike. Hi.
Hello.
Hi.
I had a situation about 19 or 20 years ago. My daughter was dating a gentleman, and he became a bit abusive, and he gave us some harassment over the telephone. So I filed a complaint against him, and they issued a warrant for his arrest. He moved out of state, and recently, he was in a car accident, or they stopped him for traffic, and they saw the warrant, so they arrested him.
Wow.
And I received a, we all forgot about it, to be honest with you. And we received a letter from the state's attorney saying we should appear at trial on such and such a date, and to file electronically with the state's attorney that I will be a witness. Do we need representation?
No, you don't. And I'd like to know a little bit more. Maybe you can email me what you received, because if it was a subpoena.
No, it wasn't.
Okay, it wasn't a subpoena. I guess maybe they're asking if you're still interested in being a witness. I'm not sure of that document.
Yes.
Okay. And if you don't want to be, you can say no. But if they subpoena you and they tell you they want you to come, then you have to go. I would imagine that you don't want to be involved in this, because that's water under the bridge, and why bring this up again and, put
fuel
on the fire?
Well, actually, we called the state's attorney, and they said, we would like you as a witness. We're asking you to do it voluntarily. But if you don't comply as a witness via the Internet, then we will have a judge subpoena you.
Okay, well, then I would say then comply and do it voluntarily, because at least if you're doing it voluntarily, they might be a little they might give you, like in scheduling. So if it's a bad day for you because you can't go to work or whatever, they might be a little bit more amenable to being flexible with you if you comply rather than be subpoenaed.
Right.
So yeah, if they said either or, you're going to go, either way you're going to go, might as well just do it voluntarily.
Yeah.
But you don't need a lawyer, because you're going to tell the truth. And, the truth is what the truth is, and you're not in trouble and you're not being accused. And all you need to do is go there and listen to the questions that are being asked and tell the truth. And if it's a good state's attorney, they're going to prepare you. They're going to, you're going to know what they're going to ask you. And if there's documentation, they're going to show it to you. So there's no reason for you to hire a lawyer and spend that money. But thank you for the call, Mike.
Okay.
Good luck to you.
Thank you.
All right.
Bye.
Sarah, welcome to the show. It's Karen Conti. How are you?
I'm doing well, thank you. And I really hate to go back to the divorce issues, but
sure,
that's where we are. My daughter went through a divorce about 12 or more years ago, I'd have to think. I think it was 06. And I know the decree said that he was supposed to pay for half of things like medical bills, et cetera, and so forth. And so far as I know, she has not submitted request from him, but the younger daughter, the last one, will be 18 this coming Wednesday. And right before the holidays, she put her out of the house because her behavior became so bad. Part of that was being fed through the father. But it was really bad, and she put her out and asked him to take her in so that she didn't have to go onto the street. Now, he's had her since, say, the end of December, and now he's suing her for child support.
Oh, my goodness.
And he never paid any of the half of the medical or half of the school expense. All of those things didn't get paid for. And whenever she was short of money, I chipped in because I just felt like I wanted them to have it.
Sarah,
want to know,
yeah,
if she gathers the stuff up now, even though she never presented it to him before, can she stop this thing? And
okay, let me ask you just one question. Sarah, is the girl graduating from high school this coming May or June?
Yes.
Okay. So, you know what? I'm going to put you on hold because I got an echo here. I feel like I'm in a cave.
I'm sorry.
Can you listen to the radio? You can listen to the radio, right?
Okay. I can hear you, and my radio is on in another room, and I found it interesting.
Okay.
Well, why don't you walk in there and listen.
Go to the other room and listen on the radio. Okay, because I can't even talk and listen to myself echo. So Sarah's question is, can the father ask for child support? So she's going to be emancipated in June when she graduates from high school. It's 18 or when you graduate from high school. So December, January, February, March, April, May, June. So 7 months of child support. I don't know that I'd even bother to do that. I mean, why would he even bother to get child support for seven lousy months, especially when he owes money on these other things? I think that, Sarah, you might have your daughter get a lawyer and have the lawyer write a letter saying, we have all of these unpaid expenses. They're going to total X amount of dollars. If you're going to seek child support for these last few months of time, then we're going to ask for arrearages. That's the word for the money that you owe in the past. And maybe we just call it even at this point, because you don't want to go through a hearing and you don't want to spend money on child support when, this doesn't make any sense that he would even do that. Boy, it's just, he didn't have the child for all this time, and now he wants to go after you for child support. Interesting. But that's my best advice. And hopefully by sending that letter, he will back down. If not, you're going to have to go to court and then go through a child support calculation and figure out exactly how much you owe for that period of time, unfortunately. Do I have time for one more, Ben, or should I take a break? Take a break. And now when I come back, I'm going to get John. John's on the line, and I'll get to your question. 981-7200. Give me a call. I've got some questions about the Smollett case that I want to get to. And you can also text me, 981-7200. You're listening to The Karen Conti Show on WGN. We're in the home stretch, but we still have time to answer your legal questions. 981-7200. John, you have been waiting patiently. Hi, John. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Karen. Thanks for taking my call. I appreciate
it. Sure.
Me and my girlfriend have been together about 7 years now. She's been divorced for 10 years. And according to her divorce decree, she's entitled to 50% of her ex-husband's 401k. There's nothing in there other than that statement. And our concern is that he's cashed in on it, borrowed from it. There isn't anything left of it. Does she have any recourse at all? And how do we find out how much money was in there, or, where do we proceed from there?
Yes. Good question. So what happens when you get divorced and you are entitled to a portion of your ex's retirement or 401k, you should, after the divorce decree is done, have what we call a quadro inter. That's a qualified domestic relations order. Okay. And what that does is you have someone prepare that, a lawyer or an agency can prepare that for you, and then you send it to the pension company or to the 401k, whoever's holding the 401k. And at that time, what should have happened was the money should have been transferred into her 401k, or if she didn't have one, she'd have to set up a 401k and transfer that portion of the money that was 50% at the time. Okay. Now, that wasn't done, apparently. You might want to check back with the lawyer to see if it was done and you just didn't know about it. Because if it was done at the time, then that money should have been transferred, but she would know about that. And for all you people out there, please know that if you have this issue, you need to have that quadro done, because let's just say that he liquidated it, and let's just say that he borrowed against it. The money's not going to be there. So what I would do is go back to the divorce decree, see if you can call the lawyer. I don't know if the lawyer's still around. Ask if,
yeah,
that, if
he,
that... Go ahead.
He had an attorney. She did not.
Oh, okay. Oh, that's why it wasn't done. Yeah. I mean, he still owes the money. There's no question about it. But if he's broke, then where are you going to get that money?
Right.
I think that, and approximately how much would it have been? Do you know?
No idea.
Okay.
He's been with the same company for 30 years.
Okay.
So we're assuming it's a pretty substantial amount.
On the other hand, it would be 50% as of the date of the marriage. So how that's calculated is whatever was acquired during the marriage. So if he was married for 10 years and he has 20 years of 401k, she would only get 50% of that 10-year period while they were married. So it doesn't keep accumulating over time. So, yeah, once you're divorced, it cuts off the ability to get more of that money. So I guess we'd have to figure out how much could this possibly be, number one. Number two, how much money is it going to cost in attorney's fees to try to get this done? And, does she have any ability to talk to this guy and say, hey, you know, what's the status of your 401k, or are you going to have to get legal and go to court and get that information?
I see, because she thought she wasn't eligible until he retired. Then she got 50% of the 401k, not necessarily what was at the time of the divorce.
Yeah, no, I mean, okay. If it were a pension or something like that, you know, that's how that works. So you see that a lot with police officers who have a pension. They, you know, you don't get a portion of that pension until the employee starts receiving the pension. But a 401k is transferable. So it should have been done at the time. And I was going to say the lawyer should have done that, but there was no lawyer. So if you want to email me, I can maybe take a quick look at it and see if I can point you in the right direction. Okay.
That would be great. Thanks very much.
All right, John. And that is WGN at AskKarenConti.com. I had a couple texters with good questions. One is Kim Fox's handling of this whole Jussie Smollett thing. Do you believe that it's incompetent, or do you expect that there was wrongdoing involved and that it should be investigated? I would be speculating like we all are, but my guess is that she didn't do anything inappropriate, like, she took a payoff or someone used influence on her. I want to explain something about prosecutors. I have been hired by victims of crimes. In fact, I was just hired recently, and I'm not going to say names or anything like that, but there were three women who were stalked and harassed by the same guy. And so they hired me to see if I could get him prosecuted because the orders of protection were not protecting these women, and he needed to be prosecuted for some other things that he did, including assault, trespass, and some other very bad things. So, and I get that happens regularly. So I call somebody who I know in the state's attorney's office, and maybe I network to find the right lawyer. I get the information. I put all the evidence together and I send it to the prosecutor and I say, listen, this guy is a harm to society. He's done this to three women. We think there are other victims out there. Is this something that you could prosecute, please? And in this case, the prosecutor was very nice and listened to it and assigned an investigator to the case. And it looks like the guy might be prosecuted. So what I'm trying to say is there's nothing wrong for victim's family to reach out to a prosecutor. At the time, the beginning, Smollett's, you know, was a victim until he wasn't. At that point, there was Michelle Obama's chief of staff reached out to the state's attorney, and that's not inappropriate. That happens all the time. Now, should the state's attorney be talking to that person? I'm not sure. It depends if they have evidence. Are they just calling in a favor? What is the nature of the call, and what is the call asking that person to do? It looks bad. It looks like she was talking to some important person about trying to get the right to get the solution that person wanted rather than what Kim Fox thought. So it looks like it was improper. My guess is she didn't do anything improper. Why would she? I don't have any reason to believe she is a dishonest person or a bad person. But I think it was just handled wrongly. I think it was handled in a way that was not transparent. This was a case that was transparent from the beginning. We knew about the case. We knew about the evidence. We heard about the injuries and the noose and the Subway sandwich. We heard the whole thing. And now we're hearing nothing. We're hearing what was the reason the case was dropped? Why was it presented like he did community service, he's forfeiting his bond, therefore we're dismissing all charges? Since when does doing community service exonerate someone from committing a crime? As I use the example, John Gacy was a JC Man of the Year, and he did a lot of community service. He was a great guy, but he killed 33 boys. Does that mean he doesn't get prosecuted? So the whole way this was handled, in my opinion, was improper, but my guess is there's nothing. I say improper. It was handled in a way that didn't make the prosecutor's office look good, but I don't think anything was dishonest or unethical, put it that way. Another one texter called and said, or texted and said, can the U.S. Attorney General investigate any wrongdoing? Yes. The U.S. Attorney can come in and investigate anything it wants. Will it do it? I'm not sure. I'm sure they're going to reach out to the prosecutor first to maybe get some information if they have any interest in doing that. But I think this case is going to go away, and I don't think there's going to be anything further after this whole hoopla dies down. But it's been interesting.